This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story Podcast. Kamala Harris and Donald Trump offer two very different views on climate change. One of them will lead the world's greatest producer of fossil fuels and have the power to reshape global climate action. So what would a Harris or Trump presidency mean for the climate crisis? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, this is Nuala McGovern, and you're listening to the Woman's Hour podcast.
Hello, you're very welcome to the programme. Well, Sophie Kinsella will be with us in the Woman's Hour studio soon. The hugely successful author has written the most beautiful book following her diagnosis of a form of aggressive brain cancer. The book is unputdownable. We're going to speak to Sophie. Also, the COVID-19 inquiry continues. Evidence on maternity services during the pandemic was given yesterday. Some aspects of the restrictions that were introduced at the time were heavily criticised. We'll hear why, and also from a mother who says she laboured alone and now has PTSD from that experience. Some women who were pregnant maybe welcomed the safety measures that were put in place at that time. But wherever you stand, if you were pregnant during the years of COVID-19, I'd like to hear your story today about the birth or the aftermath effect of having a baby in that very particular time. You can text the programme, the number is 84844. On social media, we're at BBC Woman's Hour, or you can email us through our website. For a WhatsApp message or a voice note, that number is 03700 100 444. Also today, Imogen Grant, gold medal winner at the Paris Olympics. Well, since last night, she's also Athlete of the Year for the BBC Green Sport Awards. We're going to hear about her work and her wins, and that includes getting into what she eats and what she wears. Plus, we'll look at the murder of the fourth woman in 6 weeks in Northern Ireland. That is all coming up. But let us begin by going back to a time when COVID was rampant. For most people, it was a pretty grim time. And in a particular way, it was for those who were pregnant. This week, the COVID inquiry, as I mentioned, has been taking evidence about the impact on maternity services, including criticism from some that the restrictions brought in for maternity care were left in place for far too long and that they had an adverse effect on the mental health of mothers and staff. Our health correspondent, Jim Reid, has been listening in. Jim, good to have you in studio with us. This was a full day hearing yesterday. How did it begin?
Hi, Nuala. Yes, in the morning we heard what's called impact evidence. So this is when someone, a member of the public, is put forward to talk about their own personal experiences. And in this case, we heard from a young mother called Tamsin Mullen. Now, to give you some background, in 2019, she found out she was expecting twin boys. It was seen as a high-risk pregnancy, so she was attending antenatal scans every week with her partner. Then COVID happens at the start of 2020, and like many other women, her husband was told he couldn't come with her, had to wait in the car park outside. Here she is being questioned by counsel to the inquiry, Zoe Neild, and talking about how she felt at those appointments.
I was very nervous. It was really difficult to do that alone, knowing about the high risk part.
And did you speak to your husband about how it was impacting him to have to wait in the car while you were having the scans?
Yeah, he supports me 100% in everything. So having to be separated during that time that I really, really needed the support was really distressing for him to have to do.
So in April 2020, Tamsin did give birth to twin boys. They went straight into neonatal intensive care for 31 days. And through that whole month, the couple were told only one parent could be with them in the room at any one time. That was even after they were given the twins their own room. The couple described that decision as just baffling because they were living together. They were driving in the same car together to the hospital every morning. But then they get to the hospital and they're told they can't be with their babies together in the same room. Nearly 5 years on, the twins are now fit and well. Tamsin Mullen, though, described it as a very traumatic time for her family.
So that is one of the stories you heard. What about health professionals? Who did you hear from?
Well, later we heard from Jill Walton, who's led the Royal College of Midwives since 2017. She said both pregnant women and maternity staff in the pandemic had been let down by inconsistent advice, as she put it, coming from government. She said different hospitals in different areas often had different policies on visiting, for example, and that information ended up being spread and not always accurately on social media. She said in some cases this did create confusion and anger and resulted in midwives receiving verbal and even physical abuse at times.
So put this then in context, Jim, for us with the rest of the inquiry.
So this inquiry is split up into different sections. This part runs until the end of November and looks just at the impact on healthcare. Next month, I think we'll like to hear more from people ultimately in charge of these decisions, including politicians and also NHS managers, including the current head of NHS England, Amanda Pritchard.
Thank you very much, Jim. And we'll continue following it, of course, as it goes back and forth. But Jenny Ward is the CEO of the Lullaby Trust, and she's chair of the Pregnancy and Baby Charities Network and was speaking on behalf of the 13 organisations. She's with me now also in studio. Those charities cover a wide range of areas, so it can be neonatal, anti or postnatal. And there's a lot of experience to gauge from women across the UK. Some have described the impact of lockdown on pregnancy services as devastating. I did throw it out to our listeners, whatever their experience was, 84844 if they want to get in touch. But how would you describe it? Would you say it was across the board?
I think the difficult part about this is there wasn't consistency, but generally there were some guidance in place that was hugely damaging for a lot of women and for their partners as well. And particularly that was around the visitor restrictions. And one of the arguments that us as a group of 13 organisations that are parent-led and led by those people who are greatly affected by this is that in neonatal settings, in early pregnancy, in any of the maternity services, that partners shouldn't be seen as visitors in the same way they were in other parts of the hospital. They're an active part of that care and support that's there. They're there as a group.
Do you think it was possible to know back then, though? Just if we cast our mind back to those early months, particularly when we talked about Tamsin, she was, I think, June 2020, or April 2020, forgive me. So it was literally just a month after things had kicked off. I mean, hindsight is 2020, some would say.
Yes, yes, it is. And that's one of the things we discussed yesterday, was that we fully appreciate that in those early weeks and months, none of us really understood enough about what was going on, about how infection took place, and about how we can mitigate those. So, and, you know, pregnant women who were told very early on that they were a vulnerable group were worried. So we were all told to stay at home. We were told to, you know, to not go and meet people. And I think people understood that, until the point it came to their care and they realised how alone they were and how difficult that was, and also how difficult that was on the staff, because having partners there who are part of that care put additional pressures onto the staff as well.
I should also actually throw that out for the stories to maternity staff as well, 84844. I do see a message coming in. Hi, I was pregnant during COVID and gave birth to my son in January 2021. I'd had multiple miscarriages previously. I found going to scans alone very upsetting. Surely there should have been exceptions for cases like mine. That was Beth. Were there any exceptions?
Not that we saw. We have heard from families who, in individual units, there were staff kind of saying, we can get you in, or we'll use the fire escape and get your partner in, because they understood how important that was. But in general, the guidance, which wasn't enforced, but which staff took very seriously, as we all did with the guidance that we were given, was only one visitor at certain points. And for labour, that was seen as active labour. And for some places, for only an hour after the baby was born. So then the partners asked to leave.
I want to hear the story of Daisy Lane, who's also with us, who gave birth to her daughter in June 2020. Daisy, welcome to Woman's Hour. Tell us a little bit about what happened to you during that time.
Yeah, so like you just said, I had my daughter in June 2020. So at that time, we were still in the first lockdown. COVID was still quite new and uncertain to us all. So I'd spent most of the third trimester of my pregnancy in lockdown. And those restrictions were still present when I gave birth and into some of the postnatal period as well. So for me personally, that meant that I was induced alone. I laboured alone. My husband was allowed to join me when I reached a certain stage of active labour. I know this was a rule in many hospitals at the time. But I already felt pretty broken by the time he arrived. I hadn't had my advocate, my distraction, my comfort, something that's so important for women in labour who are extremely vulnerable. And so I went to birth my baby very anxious, which is physiologically detrimental to the birth.
How did they know when your husband would be allowed to join you? In the sense of that you're in active labour. Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. So it meant internal examinations to determine when I was in active labour. So that actually meant an increase of women requesting such invasive examinations, really. I'm sure there was an increase at that time because we were also desperate to know, okay, at what point can my birth partner be with me? So it was when I reached, I think, 4 or 5 centimetres dilation, mm-hmm. basically. So after my little girl was born, she and I had to stay in hospital for a further 5 days. She was premature. And in that time, I couldn't have a single visitor, not even my husband, not even for a minute. And, you know, I was in shock. I was extremely sleep deprived. I was a first time mum with no clue what I was doing. I'd just had a traumatic birth. And my husband was rushed out of the hospital and I didn't see him again until the following week. And I really could have done with the support, both physically and emotionally.
What do you think has been the after effect? I mentioned to our listeners briefly at the top that you have suffered from PTSD following that experience. And I'm just wondering, as you look at it now, how do you understand its impact?
In those few days in the hospital, I watched myself deteriorate daily. And I came out of the hospital a different person. It took something from me in those few days. I felt like I didn't matter. And so when I brought my baby home, what should have been a magical time was actually very sad. And I was plunged into motherhood on the back foot, really, because of that. So I was already at a low and I struggled to climb back up from that. So, yes, I was eventually diagnosed with postnatal depression and PTSD. To this day, I still resonate with the label of lockdown mom because it stays with me. I'm now 35 weeks pregnant with my second child, so I'm experiencing a very different pregnancy to my last, but it took me 4 years to contemplate the conversation of having another child, and I know many women still cannot have that conversation and may not ever.
Congratulations on your pregnancy, and I'm sorry you had to go through all that you went through. Just as you were speaking there, Daisy, I did notice other women getting in touch, and I'll come back to you because I know you've gathered some of the stories of women as well. Okay, here's Luke. Hello, I was working as a doctor in maternity during COVID. It was very distressing to have to tell parents that they had to say goodbye to their partner only 1 hour after their C-section. These poor women couldn't get out of bed to cuddle, change or care for their babies because of the pain after the operation, and they had no husband to support them in this. It was a difficult time. Here's another. I had my baby in July 2020. It was extremely traumatic. I went into labour at 36 weeks. I was in a private room but could not have my partner with me. It felt like I was in a prison cell. My partner was allowed in 10 minutes before my son was born. I was sleep deprived and my mental health was really suffering. When we left, the midwives told us to take our son home and lock the door and not let anyone in. It was extremely isolating and the effects of that experience have been long lasting. So Jenny, I'm beginning to hear a theme going through some of the stories that are coming in. Did they get into that with the inquiry at all about the afterbirth in the sense of the support for the women?
Yeah, we did touch on that a bit. Obviously, speaking about early pregnancy, speaking about antenatal and when women gave birth was one area. In terms of the postnatal care, health visiting services were stopped in March 2020 completely. There was nothing there. And they were reinstated a few months later. But I think anybody who works in that area can say that that was a huge mistake. That shouldn't have happened. So of the 13 organisations there, they, all of us took a huge increase in the contacts from families who Throughout this process, the big word that was coming out was they felt isolated, scared and isolated, and they really wanted somebody to listen to them.
And I suppose isolation was the big thing. Pregnant women were often considered clinically vulnerable in those early months. I mean, does that come into it at all, Daisy? And I understand you've been through something very traumatic, but in the sense of that people were trying with some of these measures to keep you healthy so that you wouldn't get COVID, so that your baby and you would be healthy?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think most people, including myself, respected and understood the need for the restrictions. And should history repeat itself, I would abide by them again, as would many others. But it doesn't mean that everything was done in the right way. Less than a month after I gave birth, pubs were permitted to reopen. A few weeks later, we were then financially incentivised to eat out to help out at restaurants. And still at that point, mothers were giving birth alone. And maternity restrictions were some of the harshest and longest lasting in the UK. They weren't given the same focus as social pursuits with particular bias towards men, the same focus as economic gain. And so maternity care in the face of COVID, it wasn't person-centred, it certainly wasn't woman-centred, it was often inhumane. And as a result, thousands of women were broken, just like me.
More messages that are coming in. Let me see. I gave birth to my third child in January 2021 during the second lockdown. I really don't think they had learned or reviewed much from the first lockdown. It was crazy not being allowed to have your partner in the hospital for the birth of your child, as it also made the job for the midwives so much harder. I had a C-section, so I had to use them to do everything for me, help pass me the baby, put him down again, whereas my husband had been there. If he had been there, he could have done it. One more different experience. I had my daughter in June 2020. Yeah, so the same as you there, Daisy. But at the Lister Hospital in Stevenage, the staff were wonderful. We arrived. My husband waited only a few minutes before being allowed in. He then stayed throughout the birth and went home a few hours later. I feel lucky for this experience. Was that a lucky experience?
Yeah. Yes, unfortunately, that was a lucky experience. Yeah. And we know there were professionals, as I said, who did their utmost to do whatever they could. But we were all looking at those guidelines and they took them very seriously in healthcare settings.
So what do you think might happen from this, Jenny, as these stories come out, as the inquiry takes their notes on the evidence?
I hope that they will take into account the conclusions that we gave and that Jill Walton from the RCM gave, which was that we don't believe that maternity and neonatal services were prioritised. It was like there wasn't an understanding that these are essential services. We are not going to end up with waiting lists if you don't invest in these services. You end up with situations where the care is not optimal.
Did it get into, because Daisy mentioned there, you know, the eat out to help out and the other things that were ongoing or opening up. Why was there that two-track divergence?
I think that's one thing that we actually questioned and said, well, where was the communications? Where was the combined thinking of everything that was going on? And that was particularly different. If you were a parent who had your baby in a neonatal unit, you were allowed in for 1 hour a day, but then you could go out for dinner and you were encouraged to do so. That's so incredibly difficult. And they've heard evidence from people where that carried on into 2021. So that wasn't just the first few months. That kind of lack of thought of this area carried on for quite a long time.
From a different perspective, meaning the grandmother. Both my daughters had their first babies just before we went into lockdown. I had the joy and privilege to hold each of them before being torn away from my daughters when they needed their mother most and left them to cope without any other female support. I couldn't help them at the most vulnerable moments, and having held those boys, I couldn't hold them again for months. I carry such parental guilt that I wasn't there to support them while those hypocrites partied. I will never recover those early months, and my daughters both suffered postnatal depression. Back to you, Daisy, because you decided to gather the stories of women who had gone through maybe something similar to you, but definitely during those months of restrictions. What do you take away from that, and what do you want people to know?
Well, I share a lot about motherhood online. I write a lot about motherhood. And when I spoke about the impact lockdown had on me, I'd get hundreds and hundreds of messages, and I got to a point where I kind of thought, hold on a minute, there's a lot of people here with a lot of trauma who are very angry, who want to talk about this. So I created an online community for lockdown mums, and we did several projects, and the response was overwhelming. And there was there were the same threads throughout everyone's story. And so we've just published a book called Motherhood in Lockdown, and it's the stories of 150 of those women whose pregnancy, birth and or postpartum were impacted by the pandemic. And their stories are just like mine, many even more devastating. We have to remember babies were lost and mothers had to deliver that news to their partners waiting on the car park. We had one lady who could not access normal postnatal care services, so she had to show her episiotomy stitches via a video call to a doctor. There's some really shocking stories here, but themes that run through them all, and you can see the impact it's had on maternal mental health in the UK.
I want to thank you, Daisy Lane, also Jenny Ward and Jim Reid, our correspondent before you. Thanks for all the messages that are coming in as well. And no doubt we'll talk about this again. Now, the best-selling author, Sophie Kinsella, is known for the hugely popular Shopaholic series and many other bestsellers. She sold over 45 million books, which have been translated into more than 40 languages. Her latest novel is called What Does It Feel Like? And it's her most autobiographical. It tells the story of a novelist who wakes up in a hospital bed with no memory of how she got there, and she learns that she's had surgery to remove a large tumour growing in her brain. She must relearn how to walk, talk and write again. 6 months ago, Sophie shared with her readers on social media that in 2022, she had been diagnosed with glioblastoma, an aggressive form of brain cancer. It's known for its poor prognosis, with only 25% of people surviving more than a year and only 5% surviving more than 5 years. Well, Sophie's here with me in studio. So wonderful to have you with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That book.
Oh, I'm glad it spoke to you.
It's so beautiful. I was reading it on the tube and I came to my stop and I just wanted to actually sit on the bench in the station to continue reading.
That's the best thing any author could ever hear. So I really appreciate that.
You brought me somewhere else. Somewhere that you have been. And I'm sure loved ones of people that have gone or going through a serious illness will also have been. But I'd like to know a little bit first about why you decided to go public about your illness and your diagnosis. That was in April this year. Mm-hmm. Was it a difficult decision?
It was. It took me a lot of strength to go public. And I think anyone who's had any kind of news to deliver will understand that it's a difficult thing to do because of the reaction you get. And my husband and I had got used to telling just one person at a time, and that was hard enough. So it took quite a lot of guts to go out and tell, you know, a shedload of people all at the same time, this, you know, dramatic thing has happened to me. But I was actually tired of keeping it under wraps because there's being private and then there's being secretive, and it was becoming harder and harder to hide. I'd lost weight in my face, and I was due to do an event with my readers to publicise another book of mine, The Burnout. And I realised that I couldn't go up there and do an event without being honest. I've always had a really kind of close connection with my readers, and this is part of who I am now.
I was about to say, I just think people have taken you to their hearts before this diagnosis with your novels, and I can't imagine. What was the response like?
It was overwhelming. So much love poured out at me, so much support, so many messages, some just wishing me well, but others sharing their own stories, which was very moving. Good stories, and it has to be said, some not so good stories, but you know, it's all part of the reality of this situation. And I just felt blown away, really.
So in the book, our protagonist is Eve. She is an author. She writes about shopping at times, no spoilers, but has an epiphany at times. So it is fiction, but it is also autobiographical. And I just wondered when I was reading it, why is it fiction, number one? And how do you walk the line, number two?
Oh, I love that. Well, yes, the clues are there. Novelist. She also has 5 children.
Yes, I noticed. And a very nice husband.
A lot of coincidences there. I fictionalized it because I write fiction, is the simple answer. I knew I had to write about this experience, even as I was going through it. It was the most surreal and powerful and kind of extraordinary experience that had ever happened to me in my life. And I've always processed my life through writing, whether it's shopping too much or falling in love or having babies. It's all gone into my books somewhere or other. And I knew I wanted to write about it. And at first I thought, well, shall I write a memoir? I've never done that before, but I could write about this experience. And I realized that I didn't want to. I like making it up. I don't like facts. I don't like being held down to facts. I didn't want to feel that it's got to be completely accurate every single day, every doctor's name, everything. I like making up a narrative. So I decided that this was the best format for me to do a book. And as you say, it's my most autobiographical book. It's basically me.
So part of your diagnosis means that you have short-term memory loss at times, or have had at times. But the detail, it's excruciatingly perfect. And I'm wondering how, as a writer, did you do that? Do you remember those aspects of waking up in a hospital, for example, or what you were told or had to be retold at times?
Do you know? Well, I mean, the memories I have, such as they are, mm-hmm. are vivid because okay. they're so extreme. But also, even when I was in hospital, I knew that I wanted to make notes about what was going on. I knew that it was just so bizarre to wake up and you can't move your head, to wake up and you thought you could walk, but now you can't walk, to wake up and realise that you've lost days of your life, never mind the diagnosis itself. Mm-hmm. So I took notes. I couldn't write. My writing ability had gone. I couldn't hold a pen properly, but I could talk. And I could turn the dictate function on my phone and I could talk into my phone. And that's what I did.
It's like, I think, when I was reading that there are innate parts of our personality. You are a writer. And so that bit stayed solid, let's say. Your love for your husband, you wanted him to come around so you could see him when you couldn't move your head, is solid as a rock. And your children. You know, and that you wanted to, you had that maternal, where are they? Are they okay? It's so interesting, the rocks that are there, even when everything else is floating.
It is interesting because so much of me seemed to drift away. But you're right, the things that matter. And I think that having now been through the diagnosis and the kind of the horror of learning what was happening to me, I have really realised what is important to me, what is solid and what doesn't matter anymore.
How are you today? I mean, you look well to me. And
oh, thank you very much. Yeah. I feel good. I feel well. I mean, that's what's so bizarre about this mm-hmm. illness is that you can go about the world. People say, oh, but you look so fine and you look so well. And
is that helpful or not?
Well, no, I'd like to feel I look well. To be honest, the doctor always says, how are you feeling? So I always think, well, if I feel well and look well, that's got to be a good sign. That's, you know, something to cling on to.
Let's talk about some of the adaptations that Eve made. Maybe you have made, maybe you haven't. Such as the bucket list. She doesn't want to travel the world. Instead, she's more interested in Normal Plus, which I loved, like good marmalade instead of the cheaper variety in the supermarket.
Yes, that's very much from real life. So, I mean, the narrative is you're diagnosed with a terrible disease and you put on your Lycra and you climb Everest or you go and meet that movie star that you'd always wanted to meet or you, whatever it is you do, you know, you go on holiday to the Galapagos Islands. There's this sort of narrative that you're going to do extraordinary, outlandish things to celebrate life, to create memories. And anyway, I'm afraid that that narrative didn't speak to me. I just kept thinking, well, do I want to do this? Not really. Do I want to swim with the dolphins? Not really. And I realized that what I'm valuing more and more is just normal life. And the Normal Plus comes about when you just add a little treat You just give yourself a little treat and it turns a normal experience into just a slightly more fun experience.
And I should probably say as well about the book, surreal is a good word because you're kind of going through this dreamlike, nightmarish at times situation. But then there are these moments of pure joy. One, your wonderful husband who is by your side. And also, maybe this is normal plus as well, a game of Scrabble with the children that Eve uses to introduce normality, but also talk about what may or may not happen.
Yes, that again, I have to say, is from real life. So we had to tell our children, we had to choose a good time when we had a lot of days free to process the news.
I should say they're between 12 and 28, would that
yes,
be correct?
Yes, 12 and 28.
Mm-hmm. Five.
Five of them. Yes. Yes. People kept saying that to me in the hospital. Five.
Five. Got it.
And we wanted this to be, you know, dialed down in terms of drama. We wanted it to feel like a normal family conversation, like this is just another challenge. We all have challenges in our life. This is bigger than some of them, but we're going to deal with it in the same way that we do. And we told them in the most gentle way that we could, not being deceitful, but not over dramatizing it. And then we played Scrabble. And it was the best thing to do because everyone could kind of talk about the Scrabble, but talk about the news, and we blended it all together. And it was the best way, I think, for us as a family to process it.
And being together, but talking about being told this terrible truth, I guess. Nick in the book, Eve's husband, has that job, but has to tell Eve again and again because of short-term memory loss.
Yes. Yes, and this was us. So I would forget. I would wake up every day and I'd forget. I'd forget who the nurses were. I would forget why I'm in hospital. And I had been told that I had cancer, and then I would forget. And my husband had to tell me again.
And then you would have to go through all those emotions again of hearing that news.
Yeah.
And what about him?
I think it was really hard for him, really hard. He showed his love for me at that time more than he ever has, because he would just patiently tell me again and wait for me to react. And I don't know how we got through it, but we did, just with love.
I thought when I finished the book, I was like, that is a love story.
It is a love story. It is. It is. I mean, we have had a steadfast love throughout this whole experience, and it has brought us together. And you know, it's not a depressing book.
No,
it's hopefully funny in places and optimistic, and that reflects what life has been like for me. I haven't just woken up every day and burst into tears. I've laughed, I've found joy, I've enjoyed all the things, the normal plus.
Normal plus,
normal,
I love it.
Plus is my new watchword. I enjoy life, and I'm determined to enjoy life for as long as I can.
What do you want people to understand from the book? I felt I understood somewhat, obviously as an observer, what you and your family have been going through in some small part by reading the book. But I'm wondering what your motivation was in writing it.
Well, what I find interesting is that if you had asked me before this happened, you know, you're going to be diagnosed with incurable brain cancer, how are you going to react? I would have predicted that I would collapse on the floor, a puddle, a weeping mess, and be unable to cope. And I think a lot of people feel that. People get very worried about their health. They get health anxiety. They go for scans they don't need. They catastrophize about what it would be like. And I'm here to say that you can have that terrible diagnosis. You can have the bad news and the scan and the doctor's room and the whole story. But you can still lead your life. You can enjoy life. You can find pleasure in day-to-day activities and the love of your family. And you don't have to collapse. And it may not be as bad as you thought. And that's what my experience has been. And I just hope people can read it and enjoy it and find hope and laughter amid the bad news.
What Does It Feel Like is her latest novel. My guest has been Sophie Kinsella. I wish you all the best. Thank you so much for coming in.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story podcast. Kamala Harris and Donald Trump offer two very different views on climate change. one of them will lead the world's greatest producer of fossil fuels and have the power to reshape global climate action. So what would a Harris or Trump presidency mean for the climate crisis? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you very much.
Now, to a murder investigation that has been launched after the body of a 22-year-old woman, Mary Ward, was found in South Belfast. The Police Service of Northern Ireland, that's the PSNI, have referred the case to the Office of the Police Ombudsman. She's the fourth woman to be murdered in the space of 6 weeks in Northern Ireland. Earlier this year, the PSNI released figures and it showed that in the 5 years between 2019 and 2024, 30 women and girls across Northern Ireland were killed by men. To put that into context, the population of Northern Ireland is just a little under 1.9 million. Alison Morris is the crime correspondent for the Belfast Telegraph and joins us now. Good to have you with us, Alison. You know, I was reading a study by Eurostat and it says that Northern Ireland has the third highest femicide rate in Europe. Why?
I think there is a number of reasons. And when we come to, obviously, the murder of Mary Ward, as you've said, there has been numerous killings in the last number of years, but this is actually the fourth murder of a woman in the last 6 weeks in a very small population. A lot of them actually in the same sort of geographical area. We have a legacy, I suppose, coming on from our conflict. At times, people have called this an armed patriarchy. It's a very patriarchal and misogynist society. And I think the rights of women always were secondary to our security situation, whether that be in terms of how women were viewed, but also in terms of our policing and security situation. It was on a security footing. It was there to deal with, obviously, paramilitaries and conflict, and the rights of women seemed to be secondary to that. And we know that women and children are the first casualties of war, and we're coming out of a war-like situation. And therefore, I do think that we're very late catching up in terms of legislation to protect women.
So the legislation, but I'm also really interested in what you talk about there as the culture of an armed patriarchy. I mean, sometimes post-conflict around the world, we do sometimes see that what has happened within a conflict then bleeds out into the society at large in the years following the conflict. Is that how you understand it?
Yeah, I mean, we still have paramilitary structures. We still have people who control entire neighbourhoods. Now, if you're the partner of one of those men and that you're being abused and you phone the police, well, you're going to be the person that's going to have to leave their home. You're going to have to flee. You're going to be viewed as someone who's informed the police on your partner. We have had cases in the past where people have been convicted of historic troubles, crimes that have been committed because there was DNA taken from them after they were arrested for attacking their partner. So you can see the pressure that that's putting on women as well when it comes to reporting these type of very violent men. But also, our legislation has been so slow catching up. We are the last jurisdiction to have coercive control legislation, to have stalking legislation, to have non-fatal strangulation legislation. All of these things we were playing catch up with. And, you know, I've even noticed when I go back and look through the archives, even 15, 20 years ago, the murders of women are placed somewhere in the back of the paper, whereas anything that's troubles or conflict related tends to be put on the front page. And it's something that people like myself have been really trying to turn around and trying to highlight this type of crimes against women.
I want to mention the names of the people, Mary Ward, we did, who was killed recently. The others were Rachel Simpson, Sophie Watson, Montserrat Martorell as well, making up the four in the past 6 weeks. But you mentioned paramilitary men. Is that who you were saying are some of the men doing this, or what do you see?
In terms of the domestic violence, there's clearly a large number of men who have pasts in that they would be known to the police for other criminal activity. We also have people suffering from severe mental health problems, and an increase in what we're also seeing is older children attacking their mothers or grandmothers. And that's, I suppose, when we look at the financial situation that we're in, where older children have to remain living at home for longer periods of time. They don't have the money. There's a housing crisis to move out. And then if you have someone who has mental health or drug problems,
living in the home, it's leading to violence. That's probably one of the most growing areas that we're seeing of domestic violence against women is son on mother, which is really frightening. I mean, if you think about, you know, you can have a very large 16-year-old child who looks like a man, and yet you have, you know, his mother trying to control him, and police are being called to those kind of incidents a lot more. But it's still the most dangerous, and we know this, it's still partner violence, and that is the large overwhelming number of these killings are done by a partner or ex-partner.
And one of the sons was in one of these cases as well involved. But I did see that the Police Service of Northern Ireland have referred themselves to the Ombudsman. What do you think that might change?
Yeah, Mary Ward was a very vulnerable individual. She was someone who would be considered by many of the statutory agents to have been vulnerable and susceptible to violence. She was last seen on the 25th of September. We know that her body was found on the 1st of October, and yet we were only hearing now that this is a murder investigation. So the police have referred themselves to the Ombudsman in terms of their previous contact with Mary Ward, and was everything done that should have been done at that time? Now, why is this significant? Well, we've just been reporting widespreadly on the murder of a young woman, a show jumper called Katie Simpson, who was murdered by her sister's partner. And for over six months, police treated that as a suicide because her partner, her sister's partner, claimed he had found her hanging, despite the fact she'd been very violently sexually assaulted, despite the fact that nurses in hospital raised concerns that she didn't look like it was a hanging, it looked like she'd been very badly assaulted. All of this went on, and so the police have had to answer questions in relation to that, and it's rightly so that they are referred to the Ombudsman, who is the watchdog, who will investigate to see if there's anything could have been done to prevent this, but also if there's any learning from these situations in terms of protecting vulnerable women like Mary in the future.
And I will just refer people to the BBC Action Line if they have been affected by any of the issues that we're speaking about. I do want to read from the head of public protection, Branch Detective Chief Superintendent Lindsay Fisher, who responded on Mary Ward, saying she is the fourth woman to be murdered in Northern Ireland in just 6 weeks. It is absolutely appalling. Four families have been shattered forever by meaningless violence. As a police service, we recently revised our Tackling Violence Against Women and Girls Action Plan and adopted the new national framework to align our response to this violence and that of terrorism and serious organised crime. Following a review of our previous engagement with Mary, the case has been referred, as you talk about, to the Office of the Police Ombudsman, whilst at this time there is no suggestion of individual criminality or misconduct. We are nonetheless concerned about our organisational response. Just before I let you go, Alison, I'm just wondering, with women, are they talking about this? How much is it off the conversation in Northern Ireland?
It is. It's spoken about a lot, and among my own friendship groups, we talk about this a lot, and also about what can be done in terms of preventing it. So we know what we need. We need that, not just do we need a strong criminal justice response, we need to see sentences that are deterrent. You know, I'm a crime reporter. I look at the court list and I see the same perpetrators on that court list week after week with the same charges, facing the charges of violence against women. And the only thing that changes is the name of the victim beside them, because they just jump from one violent relationship to another. Their victims become increasingly vulnerable as they go along. And there's not the proper criminal justice response to that. We need that. And we also need proper education from an early age, so that not just young women, but also young men recognise what a normal relationship looks like. We like to think that people learn that in the home, but they don't always have that home role model, and we do need to have an education piece to go along with this.
I want to thank you, Alison Morris, crime reporter for the Belfast Telegraph, joining us from Belfast today. People responding to Sophie Kinsella. So amazing listening to Sophie this morning, talking about giving herself little treats to lift life from the sad to the special. I like to think I try to do this in life generally. It seems important to keep a smile on your face and be able to cope with all that life throws at you. Now, athletes, they usually measure their success in silverware, whether it be medals or trophies. But the BBC has another gong it gives out to sportsmen and sportswomen, where the prize is less silver, more green. I'm talking about the BBC Green Sport Award. It's awarded to athletes who are working hard to enact and inspire change. And I'm delighted to say, a little bit earlier on today, I was joined by this year's winner, the British rower Imogen Grant. Imogen won gold in the women's double sculls at Paris, but also spends her time campaigning for a cleaner environment. She gave me her reaction to be named the winner of the BBC Green Sports Award.
It's been absolutely amazing. The award show last night, it's the third time that the Green Sports Awards have been run, and there was over 200 people down in the Radio Theatre, and every single person in that room has such passion for sustainability, and to be recognised by people that I'm looking up to as leaders in their fields, whether that's water quality or plastic pollution or heat and excessive rain, flooding. I mean, it was amazing.
It's interesting though, it's sustainability, isn't it? Because some, when they think about it, become overwhelmed. But yeah. That's not you?
I think I definitely started as someone who knew that they cared about it, but just didn't know how to attack this huge, enormous problem. But what I've really found is that every step that I've taken, one small choice, it gives me momentum and motivation for the next one, and actually confidence as well. Because when I first started speaking about it more openly, I was worried there was going to be backlash and people would call me a hypocrite and things like that. But that's just not true.
Why a hypocrite?
I think we all live in this world and none of us can be perfect. I drive a car to work and I use petrol, and we fly to our competitions because we can't afford to take the time out of training. And there's so much structurally that I don't have control over. And for me, sport has been about controlling the controllables when we're preparing to race, focusing on what we can do. And I've been trying to apply that to my own choices as well. So choosing what I eat to make it more sustainable, choosing what I wear, those are things I do have control over and can make a difference.
So interesting. The steps you're talking about, it does sound almost like a training program. Yeah. But let's talk about what you eat. You're vegan. Maybe, is it unusual in your elite circles?
Reasonably, yeah. I'm the only vegan on the rowing team, but there are vegan athletes out there, and vegan athletes doing really well. And I think some people are surprised because they think, oh, you need the meat and you need to be strong and how do you get protein in? But I hope that I can stand here and go, look, I'm healthy and fit and I'm not eating anything, meat, dairy, eggs.
Is it hard?
No, I really love it. I think the food that I eat is really delicious and really varied. And I think you've got to be a better cook with better flavours make it taste good.
Yeah, because I'm just thinking, though, on the road, like I'm even talking about it, when I'm working in the field, it's always just hard to get the food that you need at the times that you need it. And I am by no means an elite athlete. So I'm just thinking for you, you know, when you're travelling, going, planes, all that kind of stuff, whether it's tricky.
Yeah, I mean, it can be really tricky and it does take more preparation. I have to tend to bring more food with me and pack my own lunches and pack my own snacks so that I know that I've got stuff that makes me feel good. But athletes do that anyway. But I think what I'd say is that perfect is often the enemy of good. And for me, sometimes I get caught short, you know, and the last thing I want to do is sacrifice my performance and resent this choice that I've made. So I'd rather be plant-based 100 days and then one day go, oh, I've made a mistake. Right, I'll have something that I'm not sure is vegan or not sure is plant-based, and then I'll go back to doing what I was doing before, because 98% good is better than 0%.
I like that sentiment, and also the not resenting your choices. And I should say, it may not be for everyone. And of course, do speak to your doctor if you are thinking about changing your diet. So that's what you eat. Water is in the news this morning. Water companies have been ordered to return £158 million to customers via lower bills next year after missing key targets on issues like pollution. And it's the industry regulator Ofwat that announced this rebate following its annual review of water and wastewater companies' performances in England and also in Wales. But you think about water a lot, obviously, as a rower. But part of why you won this award is your work relating to rivers. Tell me a little bit about your connection with them, what you've seen, and why you're so passionate about trying to change it.
Yeah, I think my connection, I guess, is somewhat obvious. I spend anywhere between 1 and 5 hours in a rowing boat on the water most days when I'm training full time. And we're doing that all hours of the day, all seasons of the year. And I've been doing it for 10 years now. So I've seen the rivers change and I've seen them flood and I've seen them be filled with scum and sewage. And I've also seen incredible wild birds and amazing fish and even a seal in the Thames once. And I think for me, seeing that change and wanting to do something about it has really motivated me to speak up and work with the Rivers Trust to try and clean up our rivers.
And what do you make of what you're seeing so far? I mentioned that news line this morning, and I do know after the report being released that the Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs said the Environment Secretary would be writing to the chairs and CEOs of every water company laying out the performance improvements that he expects them to make in the coming year. Do you have faith that things will turn around quickly?
I really hope so. This is a massive step in the right direction, and water companies should be leading the way to try and clean our rivers up rather than being on the back foot, being defensive and frankly, giving bonuses to their bosses when they should be trying to clean up their own acts. I think there's a long way to go, though. Our rivers have been on a steady decline for over a decade. But it's not just the water companies that have responsibility there. We all live near a river. There's hundreds of them in the UK. There's a bit of water for all of us, and we can all take a bit of responsibility for keeping them healthy.
Let's talk about your rowing career. You won gold in Paris, and you came into the Woman's Hour studio with a BBC lanyard around your neck. But I was like, oh, shame it's not a gold medal. But then you produced out of your pocket, let's do it again. We shall do it through the magic of radio to our listeners. Your gold medal.
My gold medal. It's a weighty thing. Weighs 530 grams, I weighed it. So it's really the equivalent of having a small bag of sugar hanging around your neck. It's one of the most special things I think I'll ever own.
And when you say a bag of sugar, but this is a lot sweeter even than that. Because
yes, it really is.
You had a difficult time in Tokyo. I was watching your interview that you did with your a companion, Emily Craig, double sculls as you did. You missed out, you came, should I say, position of fourth in Tokyo, and they took gold in Paris, which must have been so much sweeter.
Oh, absolutely. I think you can just never assume anything in sport. We knew things were going well going in. We'd been unbeaten, double European champion, double world champion. But I think Emily and I, we knew more than most that doesn't mean anything, because you've still got to cross the line first on the finals day, the one day that matters. And it genuinely felt like a fairy tale coming to Paris, it feeling like a home games, so many of our friends and family being there in person to watch us cross the line.
When you showed me your gold medal, there is a little bit of the Eiffel Tower on the front of it. Can you explain?
Oh, it's absolutely amazing. I mean, I might be biased, but I think the Paris medals are some of the best that have been designed. But it's one of the really special things that they did for the Olympics and Paralympics in the design of the medals. They've included a little piece, a little hexagon of iron from the Eiffel Tower in the front of the medal to make it just that little bit more Parisian.
So beams that weren't being used have been then put to very good use, and a little bit of the Eiffel Tower is currently in the Woman's Hour studio.
It is.
But you talked a little bit about travelling and some of the environmental impact that that can have, the things that you're trying to do. We talked about eating, for example, what you eat, speaking out, obviously, about the waterways as well. But just before you came in, I was reading, you plan to be a seamstress and a knitter. Is this true? Are you already?
Yeah, I mean, I'm wearing clothes that I made today.
Okay, let's have a look. Stand up
and have a look.
I'll speak to you. Okay, so we have the cutest blue top with little dancing penguins.
I think they're or are seabirds. They, I think we've got puffins and seagulls.
Oh, seagulls, definitely. Well, you know, you made it. And I've just seen the little grey pocket, and now you have grey. Is it trousers? Yes, it is. Yeah, so wide. Yeah, I really like a wide trouser, I have to say.
And I made my socks as well.
And you made your socks, which are beautifully kind of grid, brown and mustard knitted socks. And how long did that take?
It took quite a lot of time, but it was one of the things that has occupied me while I've been resting between training sessions for the last year. And making my own clothes has been a really important reminder, I think, that it's really hard to make clothes and it takes a lot of time. And there isn't a single clothing item on the planet that the seams haven't been made by hand, by a person making it. And when you make it yourself, it really puts into perspective how questionable it should be that a t-shirt is £5 or a dress is £10. You know, these things are so valuable and I'm going to value these because I made them myself and I want to keep them for as long as I possibly can.
The top is very cute. I really like the little dancing birds.
Thank you.
I brought that up because I didn't know that you were as adept as you are. You're the opposite of fast fashion, as you say. But you also are having an outfit made by a designer at the London College of Fashion out of your old rowing kits.
Yeah, it's so exciting. Her name's Aishwarya. I got to meet her last night at the Green Sports Awards. And this is to highlight the massive amount of sports kit waste that gets generated. It's actually one of the biggest sectors of waste and climate debt that happens in the sporting world. And I don't really think it's talked about enough.
Well, I never heard about
it. Flying and traveling and driving, but actually there's so much kit that gets made and athletes wear it, and it's all sweat wicking, it's light, it's quick drying, and so it's all synthetic. And frequently in some of the contracts as well, it can't even be reused at the end. It's contractually obliged to be burned. So this dress is really a celebration of reusing this kit, repurposing some of my old stuff that I've rode and raced in at previous Olympics into something that I'm going to be wearing on the red carpet at the Sports Personality of the Year Awards in December.
So cool. What do we know? Do we have any idea what it will look like? Do I have to wait?
I'm so excited. The designer, she's worked with repeating motifs, taken inspiration from nature, things like whale's fins or butterfly wings, and repeated them into amazing designs. So I've handed over my kit and I'll have some fittings in the next couple of weeks. And yeah, I'm going to see the design soon. I'm really excited.
Why is it that they burn the kit?
Because frequently, when the kit is replaced, it's because a sponsor's logo or a sponsor itself has changed. And so the last thing a new sponsor would want, or an old sponsor for that matter, is an athlete then wearing kit that promoted the previous one, or things like that.
It's all so exciting. You're in a very special moment, I think.
Riding the wave, just like on the rivers.
Just riding the wave. Well, continue to ride the wave and keep going for gold. Oh, one last thing before I let you go. My understanding is the Olympics won't have your event in the next four years.
That's right.
That's sad.
It is sad. My event, the lightweight women's double scull, has been taken out of the Olympics. But the bittersweet part is that it means that I get to be Olympic champion forever in that event.
I have a feeling you're the sort of person who always finds a silver lining on a cloud.
I try to.
Imogen Grant there, winner of the BBC Green Sport Award. Thanks to her for coming in. Another message for Sophie. This is from Emma. It says, it's the small stuff, the everyday things that Sophie describes that focus you and make you feel how good your life is. I came out of hospital after a life-changing operation, but all I wanted to hear was my kids running up and down the stairs, laughing, arguing, singing. I wanted to feel the cool sheets of my bed, to hear the sounds of my house during the ebb and flow of daily life. Even now, years later, I tap into those feelings. Tomorrow, we've one of the best-loved actors, Alison Steadman. She's discussing her new memoir, Out of Character, and I'll be speaking exclusively to Dr. Hilary Cass and getting her reflections 6 months on from publishing her landmark review into Child Gender Services. See you tomorrow. That's all for today's Woman's Hour. Join us again next time.
Cafe Hope on BBC Radio 4.
By the time I'd finished these 100 meetings, I'd raised £50,000.
I'm Rachel Burden, welcoming you into a virtual coffee shop where I chat to people looking to improve the lives of those around them.
It's about tackling isolation and loneliness.
Engaging in conversation with people, you know, can make a massive difference.
Amazing individuals trying to make the world a better place.
It's a real gift.
Cafe Hope from BBC Radio 4. Listen now on BBC Sounds.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story Podcast. Kamala Harris and Donald Trump offer two very different views on climate change. One of them will lead the world's greatest producer of fossil fuels and have the power to reshape global climate action. So what would a Harris or Trump presidency mean for the climate crisis? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.